This is World Radio, KHOE, 90.5 FM, and you're listening to the program, A Chat with the Dean. I am Kathy Guarini. I'm Dean of Faculty at Maharshi University of Management, and today we're very, very pleased to have Peter Wallace with us. Some of you may have heard about how Peter learned Transcendental Meditation. Maharshi tells that story whenever he tells the story, the seagull story, about how SIMS, Students International Meditation Society, was started. So, people have heard that story. And Peter, what I'd like to hear about now is how you got your brother, Keith Wallace, involved in Transcendental Meditation.
Oh, all right. Keith was in a very fine boarding school in New England. And he was a very, very special person, and we all just loved him when he was a couple of years younger than me, but we just wanted to be around him. His nurse loved him. It's unbelievable how radiant and celestial he was. I guess that's a word you can use, but anyway, he was away when I first met Maharshi in 1962 at the Los Angeles airport, and we were already meditating. We were already doing hours and hours, maybe 9-10 hours a day of meditation. So at the Los Angeles airport, we saw Maharshi, and we just kind of fell in love with him. He was so beautiful and so radiant, and that was just me and my older brother and a sannyasi that was living with us from India. And he's actually an American, but he'd been living in India for a long time. And Keith was going to Berkeley at about the time I left for India. And I went to India to be with this great saint that was very close to Gurudev. And one of the two great saints, Gurudev and Anandamayi Ma, they were the two great saints of India. And Indira Gandhi and many of the other leaders of India and so on were gurus. Both of them were gurus to them. So I didn't see Keith again until I got back from India. And what happened is that after about 5 months or 4 months with Anandamayi Ma, she sent me, it was just at the end of 1963, she sent me to see Maharshi. And that was done in very many interesting ways, which I can't possibly describe, but some of them were notes from brahmacharis, and some of them were kind of internal messages and so on. But I was quite certain that I was supposed to leave her for the first time in many months, and we had traveled all around India. And the thing with Ma was that you had this darshan, and it was stunning, literally stunning. You went into samadhi, and you were in bliss. And ananda means, of course, bliss, and it's in the absolute. But ananda maya or moy is from the subtlest level of prakriti. So that was, in fact, the experience that I and everybody else had that was around her. Anyway, we traveled all over India, and then she sent me to Maharshi, and Maharshi wasn't there. Nobody expected him. I got to Rishikesh, and they said that he wasn't coming, and they hadn't heard anything. But I had inside information, so I just said, "Well, do you mind if I sit on this rock?" And they said, No, we'll get you some fruits, we'll get you some water. And by the time I had the water, not even the fruits, this car pulls out of the jungle, and it's Maharshi, and Devinder is driving, of course, and what a wonderful experience. And Maharshi just looked over at me as if he didn't blink or anything. He just looked over and he said, "Come." And I followed him to this little hut. They hadn't really built the ashram yet, so there was no houses or anything, but this little house, little cabins. And I followed him, and I spent about 6 months with him there in Rishikesh. And after about 3 months, he taught me Transcendental Meditation. And I think that the thing that is, you're being the dean of students and so on like that here, it's important to say that I was probably the worst student of in history. It wasn't that I didn't have some native intelligence or something like that, but I just never ever opened a book or did anything. And I had teachers just beg me, "Oh, please, Peter, you know, you're so you speak so interestingly. Why don't you just keep a diary? We'll give you a good grade," you know. And I wouldn't even do that. And so I had basically wasted those first 12 years. And Marcy was talking about the difference between a recluse and a householder. And I naturally thought I was recluse. The last thing I ever wanted to do was go back into the world of my parents, Beverly Hills or wherever we were living in West Los Angeles at the time. But my dad was a dentist in Beverly Hills. And it just seemed like, you know, money and it was just... and other things were just so important to everybody, and it was very difficult to be an idealist in that world. So what happened was we had this discussion for about 3 months about the difference between recluse and householder. And this is very important because at the time in India and really around the world, it was a very, very, very strong belief that if you wanted to find God, that you had to give up your money and your position, and you had to surrender completely to God. And that's what I believed, but I wasn't the only one, because if you talk to somebody in India and you said you should learn this meditation, they'd say, "Oh no, I can't do that. I have to support my family." And you know, it's just an instinctual thing. If you've gone to a Russian Orthodox person and said you should, you know, surrender to God, they would say, "Oh no, you know, I can't be a monk," and so on like that. And so it was always thought that you had to be a recluse. So naturally I thought, you know, at that point that I was going to be a recluse because that's what I really cared about. And you know, so Marcy, I think after 3 months, kind of gave up on trying to give me subtle messages about this householder and recluse. And I just, you know, I always just thought that he was talking about me as a recluse. But when he started me to meditate, I always meditated long, long, long periods. So I wanted to be a recluse, and he was never told me what to do, never told anybody what to do, you know, like that to dominate them. But finally, he just gave me the experience. And so he said one day, I was on the door, and it was so sweet, you know, spend every day and every night with him for so long. And so he said, you know, "Where's your fruits and flowers?" And I realized I was about to be initiated. So I ran outside and I said, "They're just outside." And the tree had burst into flowers and it was all full. And the guy from the kitchen was walking by, so he washed me some fruit really fast. The rest of the stuff I had, you know, saved for a long time. And so he initiated me, and then he said, "You know the cave by the Ganges?" And I said, "Yes." In fact, it was going to be his cave eventually. They were actually building it. And so I said, "Yes, I do." And it was going to be the cellar of his house that they were going to build. So I said, "Yes, I do." And he said, "Well, I want you to go there and meditate." And so I said, "Okay." So I started to leave, and then I thought, "Well, how long shall I meditate?" And you know, and he said, no, just meditate. And so I that was fine. That was normal. And so and just as I was going out the door, he said, "Well, if you feel hungry, have some fruit. Or if you feel tired, you can lay down, you know." So I said, okay, you know. So I went there and I meditated for about 2 weeks before I had a question. And that was, is this the right mantra? Because I was an expert meditator. He had checked my meditation with the other kind of meditation I was doing, and he said, you're a great expert at this, but you should try TM. You should have that experience. Well, when I did try TM, I just completely was lost to the world. And so after about 2 weeks, I thought...
Did you have any thoughts?
I don't think so.
We always tell everybody thoughts are a part of meditation.
No, I think it was, it was just a pure experience of the absolute. And But I did come out and I did have a thought, and the thought was, how long have I been here? And I figured a couple of weeks. And then I said, well, what am I doing? I'm meditating. What's my mantra? And I said my mantra to myself, and I said, I'm not sure that's it, you know. So I came out into the blinding sunlight and found Maharshi. They said, oh, he's just walking over there. And I caught up with him, and he seemed to be going quickly to me. Everything seemed to be going quickly. And so I caught up with him, and I said, I'm not sure, you know. He said, what are you doing, you know? Like, why are you out here? And I said, I'm not sure I have I've got the mantra correctly. I just want to check it. And so he says, whisper in my ear. So I whispered in his ear, and he said, yes, yes, go back. So I went in for another week, and after the third week, I was just popping with energy. In fact, later when I became a teacher in Rishikesh in about 6 years later, I always gave lectures. I always told these three things that I experienced. One was fulfillment beyond anything that you can imagine. So when you're fulfilled, you're free to choose right action because you're not feeling the loss or the lack of something, and so you think, what would be the best thing to do? And you think of it in a very clear way, like, I want to be creative, I want to be, you know, appreciate my parents, I want to appreciate the laws of nature. And so I always explained that that fulfillment was something I clearly experienced, and the next thing I experienced was a very clear mind, you know. And for students, I mean, I can't tell you what that clear mind did for me in terms of becoming a great student, but I will in a second. But I felt that I could study anything, that I could study physics, I could study anything. I never had that feeling before. And the third thing was that I had a kind of energy that was very smooth. I think the word would be sattva in Sanskrit, but the word, it was just like I felt that I could sit and study the most complicated things without having to pop up and think what's on TV or what's like that. But I felt this smooth energy that would sustain me through really getting deeply into beautiful subjects and so on. And in fact, those things were true. And another 3 months later, I said to Marshi, so I said, at the end of 3 weeks, I said, what if I become a student? And he just smiled and he said, oh, very good. And I realized that everything he told me about the recluse and the householder didn't make any impression on me at all. It was only when I had the experience of feeling that I was a student, you know, of transcending on the mantra that was appropriate for me, on the deepest level, and then coming out and being in my dharma. You know, the flag of India is the wheel of dharma. It's all important. Any philosophy in India has to be about dharma. And any of the Puranas or stories about the great souls of India have to be about dharma, because that is the key to understanding, you know, the stress-free life where you can gain enlightenment. So, I continued to meditate for the next 3 months and be with Maharshi, and that's enough. There's a lot of stories that go on there about the other saints and so on, and wonderful things that happened, and I was so privileged to carry the skin and be with him day and night. And but really, from that moment on, I was destined to become a student. And I was destined to meet my brother, Keith, who was at Berkeley at the time. He'd just gone to Berkeley while I was in India. So when he came back on some vacation, you know, I told him about meditation and everything. I'd been traveling all through Europe with Maharshi, and sometimes he would let me sit on the stage with him, and I was always in the room next door, and I always sort of took care of him and things like that. And he was in very strange and foreign places, so he had a really close friend, someone that knew him well and knew how to respect him and love him, and it was a nice thing. We got to England after several months. I think that he taught the first advanced techniques, which I always have the greatest regard and respect for, because he was talking about people are getting onto cosmic consciousness too quickly, and they needed something to glorify the finer levels of thought so they would have a balanced life, so they would have enjoyment in life and blissful life, and they would develop all of their aspects of their nervous system simultaneously and not just get to the way where they would feel like the world is just Maya and really they just wanted to be in being like that. So it was a full program that he had learned from Gurudev and that had been passed down from Gurudev from many, many, many great saints of the holy tradition. And it was the only thing like it that I had run up into in the world. Everybody else said, be a recluse if you want to find God. And now we were being students, and eventually we would be in some profession like teaching or being artists and so on like that. But anyway, Keith loved the story of my travels when I came back, and Marshi was just up in Lake Tahoe, and so I said, well, you know, you should really meet him, you know. And then I really got excited because I realized that Keith had the potential for pure genius, although he was, you know, not taking school that seriously at that time. So, but we all knew that he was, you know, really special. I mean, he had a nursemaid, a Scottish nursemaid, that sent him shortbread for the rest of her life because they were in love with Keith, and I was in, you know, everybody was in love with Keith. And so I suddenly realized that, you know, people like me were okay, but there were some really exceptional people, you know. In the meantime, yeah, so anyway, when Keith met Maharshi, so I told Charlie, most important thing ever is for you to bring Maharshi down to Los Angeles as soon as possible. And he's going to meet my brother, and my brother's going to change everything. And so Charlie just, he did it about face. He was so beautiful. He never even said a word. He left in the middle of a meeting with all the members of this spiritual regeneration movement, and he gave over the meeting to somebody else and just left, and he flew up to Tahoe that night, and the very next day, Marshi was in Big Bear, and he was waiting for us to come. And so we got a call and said, we've got to go to Big Bear right away. So we did. And that was really, I think, the beginning of the Students International Meditation Society, because Keith and Maharshi, I stayed with them for about 3 hours in the room, and then I realized it wasn't about me, that I'd had my time with Maharshi, 6 months in fact, but that Keith and Maharshi were talking, and beautiful, beautiful things were being said and so on, but at some point I excused myself, and they barely felt me go. And for 2 days, Keith and I, and mostly Keith, were in the room with Maharshi and everybody else, Charlie Lutz, Jerry Jarvis, the Verrills, all the people in the movement, especially, were waiting outside, and they were worried because Maharshi never came out to see anybody. He was just talking with Keith on and on and on. And I knew it was magic. I loved it. And So the next day, the third day, Maharshi came down to the Olsen's house in Los Angeles, and he taught Keith to meditate. And that was really the beginning, because Keith got it completely. He was completely ready for it, and he appreciated exactly what it was. And all of his potential came to the forefront. It's hard to describe what happened. But Keith was a wonderful person and a somewhat good student and a great athlete. He was on the wrestling team in boarding school, and he was on the football team and so on. Even though he was little, he was very agile and very, very coordinated. But what happened was that all of a sudden he decided he was, with Marshi's help, he decided he was going to study physics, because Maharshi had studied physics when he was a student, and Gurudev had sent him back to finish his education. So he became number one at UCLA in physics. He transferred from Berkeley to UCLA, and he became number one. And other students even more mature and very sophisticated students from other countries like England and so on would study with him just so that they could increase their grade level, because they always, the comment was, how does he do it? How does he get straight A's? And he, in fact, was such an outstanding student for that time that that he was invited by the neurophysiology department as the leading physicist of undergraduate physicists to have a complete grant to study whatever he wanted to study because of his physics background, and they realized this connection between heart science and biology. He just had to take two classes, which he did, and then he got no master's degree, just went right into the PhD program. And whereas most of the people were studying maybe nematodes or whatever, you know, I mean, there was no chimpanzees in this department. It was all they were studying the basic cell.
Worms. Nematodes are worms, right?
Yeah. But they were basically just studying nerve cells, you know, and Keith went in right away, got the full grant, wrote up the whole program for studying human beings, which was unheard of. And I'll tell you a little story that that we had forgotten and then remembered later on, and that was when Keith was a physics student, we got a call from Jerry, and he said, Maharshi and I will meet you in Westwood in about an hour. So we were waiting on the corner, and they pulled up, and Jerry had this big Buick with the portholes on the side, you know, green Buick. And Marcia was sitting in the front seat with Jerry, and we jumped in the back, and we drove up to near the hospital at UCLA. And we went into, this is when Keith was a physics student, no idea about anything else. We went through the neurophysiology labs, and Marcia hit everything with his rose as he went along. And he talked to all the, you know, all the technicians and the doctors. And he went, and we even saw this computer, which was a reel-to-reel computer, which was the heart and soul of the neurophysiology department. It was like the most advanced computer probably in California. And and Keith realized it later, much later, that those were all the technicians and the computer that he worked with to do his PhD later. And he was so involved in his PhD that when I went to become a teacher, he stayed behind, and then he went to the next teacher training course in Rishikesh. So that was in 69, and I was there in the spring, summer, winter and spring, and he was there in the fall. And so we became teachers and so on, but the main thing was that Keith, while staying behind, was able to complete his PhD on the neurophysiology of the fourth state of consciousness, which he measured very clearly and which sort of was a revolutionary thing. It was a feature article in Scientific American. I don't think there was another scientist in that entire department that had ever had an article in Scientific American. And Keith had a feature article and was a feature speaker at NASA and all the great places, and was invited afterwards to do his postdoctoral at Harvard. And it was a real national thing. And then about that time, the Beatles started, and so that would be around 68 or something. And so so there was a huge demand for meditation, and we who were teachers traveled all over the country teaching, and eventually I settled in Newport because Keith was at Harvard, and my mother had moved back there to take care of her mother, so the family was all together. And but one thing it's sort of insignificant compared to Keith, but I had a good luck too, because when I started the little college, I had to go to a junior college because I hadn't really ever done any work before. And so when I went to the junior college, I signed up for just hard sciences because I didn't want anything subjective, because I didn't want to hear, you know, the ignorance of modern culture. And so you know, I didn't pay any attention. I just was, and I studied with Keith, which was a big thing, because Keith didn't ever want to be interrupted when he was studying physics. So I was studying undergraduate stuff, and And so I tell this story because it kind of emphasizes what transcendental meditation did for me and what it does for all students, really. Because I was walking by the administration building, and this friend of mine who we used to study together, he says, "Peter, you're on the dean's list." And I thought I was in trouble. I said, "I didn't do anything wrong, you know." And, you know, Catherine's laughing right now, so you got to hear her laugh. So, but it was amazing because he said, "No, you're the top student in the school." And I thought, what? You know, this is new for me. I never paid any attention. But I, you know, if you ever saw the periodic chart and you say that the difference between helium and lead is just a few more protons, a few more, electrons, a few more neutrons. It's only a quantitative difference. There's no qualitative difference. It's just quantitative, you know. So it's the same basic building matter of nature. And that to me was like the Vedas, you know. It was absolutely exciting. So I was in love with my classes and, you know, and top in mathematics, top in the sciences, top in history, top in philosophy. And as Maharishi said, I should study philosophy, because when I first met him, he asked me, "Do you ever read philosophy?" You know, and I said, "Oh yes, yes, Maharishi." He says, "Do you ever read the Bhagavad Gita?" And this is in Rishikesh. And I said, "Yes, Maharishi, I read the Bhagavad Gita. I have 6 copies of the Bhagavad Gita by 6 different people. Shall I show them to you?" And he said, "Yes, yes, show them to me." So I brought them out. You know, one was a big range, like Swami Swarupananda from Ramakrishna, all the way to Annie Besant, who was the Christian Science.
Yes.
Wonderful. In fact, I checked later with Vernon Katz, and he said, "Oh yeah, that was one of the best ones." But they all had the problem that, you know, Arjuna was just kind of like, he wasn't a saint, he wasn't a recluse, so how good could he be? He was just like a dumb warrior, right? So they had it all wrong. So Maharishi, without saying anything, he said, "Well, I have started a translation of the Bhagavad Gita, and it's just, would you read it? You know, would you like to read it?" And he gave me about 20 pages of typed on, you know, that onion skin paper, just typed with a regular typewriter. And I remember, this was 63, 64. So I took it back to my little hut. I had no windows, no doors. And I just read it. And I was like, all the other Gitas that I had just went out the door, because, I mean, they were gone, because Maharishi had interpreted Arjuna as being the very cream of society, the very ultimate of human development. And he had a breakdown between his heart and his mind, because he knew Dharma, but he also loved people. And somehow he had to unify those two things in order to act in this battle that he had to fight for righteousness and good to uphold the dharmas of his society.
You're listening to World Radio KHOE 90.5 FM. This is A Chat with the Dean. I'm Kathy Guarini, Dean of Faculty. And I have our guest, Peter Wallace, a very long-time meditator, one of the first initiators in the country. And he's been telling us about his transformation after he became a meditator.
There's something about that mantra on the deepest level and the nature of the mantra. The mantra I was doing before Maharishi said had a recluse tendency. And in fact, I did love the orange, as he said in that tape of his, that I wanted to be a recluse. But it would have been really a terrible life for me, because it wasn't my true dharma. And if you have the right, you know, we were taught as teachers to give certain mantras based on certain criteria so that the person would be in their dharma. And
could you say something about what dharma is?
Well, dharma, you know, is... You know, like in India, where they have family traditions, your dharma would be sort of simple. If you were a Brahmin, you'd be a Brahmin, and so on. So there's a purity in the family line. Brahmins married Brahmins, and they stayed. So dharma was, on one level, it was a national tradition of keeping a stress-free environment where people could be excellent in what they were doing and be supported very fully by their parents and so on. So basically, the most important thing, according to Maharshi, about Dharma was that you lived a stress-free life, and stress was the enemy, the opposite of enlightenment. So, but, you know, it's the flag of India. You see this big wheel of Dharma, and so it is very important. And anyway, my Dharma was to be an artist and to be an art dealer later on in life, and in fact I did go that. But it was my college education and everything that enabled me. So just practicing that mantra that went so deep, and then just coming out and thinking thoughts, I began to think correctly. And those were Maharshi's words. He began to think correctly. And so I began to think, it didn't matter what I did in life. So I thought, well, what would my parents like me to do? You know, I was already fulfilled, you understand, from going deep, deep, deep into meditation. So I was not passionate and desperate. But I like to say that I was in a clear way of thinking, and I could think, you know, that it didn't matter what I did, but what should I do? What would be the correct thing to do? And I remember how much my mother wanted me to go to college and everything, and I was thinking maybe that would be it, and that started my thinking in that direction. And it was correct thinking. And it was based on the mantra that Maharshi had given me, and based on the fact that the tendency of the mind, the natural tendency of the mind, was to go to that state of pure bliss consciousness. Just a natural thing. It's everybody's birthright. Everybody in the world, those people that don't have it, it's just not fair, really, because if society had been preserved and the philosophy and knowledge had been preserved, there wouldn't be a child that didn't have a mantra and a technique of easy, easy meditation that would put them smack square right into their Dharma and in their life, because they would be intuitive, and they would find things that would bring fulfillment and so on like that. So even in a mixed up society where people marry all, you know, people from all different kinds of professions and so on like that, and families, you can still, and we still have found fulfillment in our activity in our life. So it isn't just based on caste system or anything like that. It's based on the intuition deeply, 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 deeply at the very source of thought and source of all bliss coming up, and then just choosing from the level of enjoyment like that. And in fact, as I said before, it allowed me to become a super student, because I loved what I was studying. I loved the subjects. And it didn't matter whether it was any form of mathematics or any form of science or any form of liberal arts and history, philosophy. I loved it. And Maharshi said something like, I could study philosophy. And in fact, I really did love philosophy. And that Bhagavad Gita story is the, you know, sort of where he got his inspiration, I think, from that, as it was a natural next step for me to look at all the philosophies of the world and so on. But in fact, I became a good student, the best student in my school, but I was nothing like Keith. And I got the privilege of helping Keith do some of his initial research, and that involved moving very cumbersome equipment down to the center, and then I was his first subject because...
Was that his PhD work?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And his PhD work, and so we had one meditation room was set up with... all these things that would stick on your head, you know, and then now they have just a simple cap they pull over, but back then you had to tape everything on and so on. It was awkward. And then Keith would measure me and do baseline things, experiments like that and so on. One thing I know I was good at, and that was meditating. So I could provide that. But then later I actually helped Keith calibrate equipment, like the galvanic skin response, which is sort of the polygraph thing. And I used to be very playful for that, you know, and just say, well, how objective is this? So I would, like, ask people, like, are you comfortable now? And then no thing on the polygraph and everything. And then after a while, I'd say, now are you on the mantra or have you forgotten the mantra? And all of a sudden, they'd forgotten the mantra, you know, and there'd be this huge spike. So I said, oh, okay, this is only objective. When you do it objectively, you know, you have to be really careful. So, but, you know, but Keith, of course, went way, way beyond that initial thing. And years later, when we were talking, we talked about the time that Marcy had taken him through all those departments. And he remembered and he thought, oh, that was the computer I used to do my PhD. He said, the first time it ate it completely, I lost all my data. And then I had to start again. And that's when I got to go to teacher training and he didn't. Because he had to start all over again. And by golly, he did. And it was even better. And it became that feature article in Scientific American. So, you know, but those are the same technicians, the same, you know, microscopes and all the equipment and everything. And so he was like, Marshy had prepared it. When he was a physics student, we had gone through the same labs. And then for some reason, we'd forgotten about it until later. And then we had this memory of, you know, Marshy putting his flower on this microscope and that. And, you know, so it was amazing. But Keith had, you know, was not only was he a great scientist, and as Marcy said, the first scientist of the world, but he also a scientist of the Age of Enlightenment, but he also was just a great person and loved by everyone. And so he was able to work with Nat Goldharber for starting, you know, a university in Santa Barbara and then moving it here. And he was able to do a lot of things. And then he moved to Flow Drop later on and worked with Maharaj, and he worked with the German scientists over there, and Samantha, his wife, worked on the Ramayana with them. So they worked there and worked there. And God bless Bevan, he took over and ran this place so beautifully. And, you know, he and he's continuing to inspire us all. I'm on the Invincible America course, which is, to me, it's the fulfillment of life to be able to dive deep every day and do the internal research. And we work with Bevan, like, continuously every day on over the telephone or whatever, however we can communicate with him. With the ladies and the men, both are in doing, hearing his voice, and we give our experiences and he comments on them. And he has a wealth of knowledge. Like, I can't believe the knowledge that he has. And it's all Maharshi's knowledge, and he has preserved it all carefully, you know, in loving, loving care for the purity of everything that Maharshi says. And I can just see why he was chosen to really have this job of keeping Maharshi's knowledge absolutely pure and taking us to the forefront. You know, some people say, oh, Peter, you speak about the history of the movement. And my latest comment in the dome was, no, this is not the history of the movement. The history is now. Now is what it's really happening. Because every time somebody gives an experience, and Bevan points out the genius in the experience and the profundity of the experience, he said, it's making, you know, all those papers are collected, and they're all saved, and they're all given to Maharaj and everything. And Maharshi loved, you know, commenting on them before, and he always had Bevan make comments. So it's a tradition that goes on, and it's profound, and the knowledge is so intact. And I don't know how Bevan has so much intelligence and so much heart, where he doesn't forget anything. And so this is a real history right now, and nothing is more exciting than right now. This is really the exciting time. If somebody's out there in the field and you know, and they want to make a decision about their life, they should seriously consider being on this IA course, because it's an opportunity of a lifetime. It's the most profound thing. You go from having fairly clear experiences in your meditation to having crystal clear experiences. And it's precious. And there's a lot of time dedicated every day to just having great experiences and being whole, a whole person. And the experiences I heard today and the experiences I heard yesterday and the experiences I heard the day before, for both the ladies and the gentlemen are just unbelievably profound, and I'm really, really very glad to be included in this group. I don't, you know, yes.
This is fascinating, and I do want to ask you, you know, it sounded like when you were in India with Ananda Mayamoy and
Ananda Mayamoy.
Okay.
Hindi, or you can say it in Bengali.
Okay,
it's
okay,
pronounced
okay,
a little different.
Okay. So you were with her, and then you were with Maharshi, and especially in the early days. And you must have been around people with very interesting experiences, very profound experiences, and yet you feel like the ones you're hearing today are special.
Very, very special. I know Maharshi was thrilled when he heard the course, you know, starting in 06, and I know he was continued to be thrilled, and it's only gotten better and better, and things that were extraordinary in 06 and 07 are now taken for granted. We're going beyond that. It's not always the specific nature of the experience that is what gets Maharshi and Bevan's approval. But it's the fact that it's interwoven with true bliss. Not a mood of bliss, but a mood, but the real pure experience of first Ananda, which is undifferentiated bliss, and manifesting on the subtlest levels of Prakriti, which is nature, on the level of Anandamaya, the fundamental level of all experiences in Anandamaya. And so, you know, the saint that I was with that introduced me to Maharshi again was Anandamaya Ma, and she was very close to Gurudev, and when Gurudev left the body, many of the Dande Sannyasis came to be with her and have darshan with her. And so it's fascinating because I got to know the Shankaracharya and the Dande Sannyasis before I got to know Maharshi. And I meditated in the same places they meditated and traveled with Ma with them. And so it was a very good introduction, and I sort of civilized me a little bit so that I could be around a great saint without being a disturbance.
Well, I just love hearing that you feel like now is the real time, because, you know, that's where we are now. We certainly can't go back to those times 40 years ago, and it's very true. It's just wonderful to hear that.
I must say that in India, there's a saying that you can judge a great saint, a great teacher, by the profundity of his or her students, mm-hmm. by their enlightenment and the fullness of it. And what we take for granted, because we're sitting in this warm tub, you know, and so it doesn't feel either hot or cold, but what we take for granted, but people that come from California or New York or Colorado, when they come here, they experience the crystal clarity in their meditation that they have never experienced before. Just beautiful, like they've been here for years already, that people take for granted here. And so that's why I think Maharshi initiated the process of giving experiences, because it's an open communication, and people can identify with experiences they've had, and then instead of just taking them for granted, they start seeing how they're the building blocks of enlightenment. And it's amazing, but it's so innocent. There's no mood making. There's no idea that people walking around saying, I'm a saint. But when I walk through the door and show my badge in the dome, I'm walking through the door with some of the most profound individuals ever to live in this world. And so, yes, you can judge the greatness of a teacher by the greatness of the students. And we're just now getting to the point where it's starting to be evident that the greatness of Maharshi is really, really profoundly manifesting in just the simple and loving people, the Trotikas of the tradition, you know, who are just having these great experiences, but aren't you know, trying to find disciples for themselves or doing anything else, but just keeping the teaching pure and doing, you know, the recertified teachers are just loving to continue to teach exactly as they learn to teach and sharpening their skills so that it's purer and purer, so this tradition doesn't get diluted by individual egos, but by their love and devotion of this tradition which goes back to the very beginning of time.
Jay Gurudev, I think on that note, we'll just thank Peter for speaking so much. Stan has a question.
Ask Peter a question here.
Stan Stensbury.
Peter, not everyone can be on the IA courses, you know. What advice would you give those who can't have that long meditation time during the day to enhance their experience? Maybe something to do with routine might.
Yes, and that brings up so many of Maharshi's, so much of his knowledge of having good food, getting rest, getting to sleep on time, really just being innocent in meditation, don't try to solve business problems and things like that. But if you do, you do. I mean, you know, the charm is there, so you can't hit yourself over the head. Just be simple. But those of you who are, for example, serving Maharshi in all of the beautiful, beautiful things you do, if you're dean of faculty, if you're head of KHOE or whatever, it's a beautiful thing to serve, and that is part of the path. So I could go off the long rounds and do something with my brother or with somebody else here and teaching or something like that. And really, I mean, teaching is like teaching the students in these, you know, if I get a chance to come in, like I am tomorrow, I'm going to give a lecture to the senior boys. And really.
At MSAE?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is going to be like, I did the a lecture for Susan's class, the senior girls, and I mean, it was just so wonderful. And you realize that this is a new generation that is completely evolved beyond anything that we could imagine. But, you know, regular dome attendance is like very important. So if people are serving Maharshi or serving in the community in some way, they should just make a real clear rule that they don't, you know, miss out on their regular attendance. Because not only are they going to get rid of all that stress that they pile up from working in investment or some field like that, or even serving where you are tempted to stay up late and do things like that. But getting good rest and being in the dome on a regular basis, you can't miss. It's like, it's 100%. So serving is a great path, and, you know, many, many people have taken that path that are the leaders of our movement, you know, and serve with their whole heart and so on. And obviously, if you look at them, you can see how they evolve. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. So, you know, it's all here. It's, you know, there's no contradictions or anything like that. The IA course is a wonderful, wonderful thing. The Purusha program, the Mother Divine program, wonderful. The advanced techniques, absolutely gift. To take somebody who's reached a certain level of development and then you just add something that is like a fertilizer to a rose, and that takes them on to the next level. And of course the students are getting the cities and they're so advanced too. So the whole program is well, it's just perfect. It's not well thought out, it's perfect. And it's not only Maharshi's genius, but it's the genius of this whole tradition that goes back since the beginning of time and through all the yugas and so on. And somehow is preserved for us so that we don't end this world by violence and things, you know. When I got on the airplane for India to find Anandamayi Ma, they had just shot Kennedy and John Kennedy, and there wasn't a person on the airplane that wasn't crying. And when I thought of it later and I heard Ma speaking, to some of the saints and so on about what Maharshi was doing, and she supported him entirely. She said, you know, that this world could end so easily with the technology we have now. And I can't translate it literally because it was given to me by someone else, translated by her secretary to me after this meeting. But she said, if Maharshi hadn't gone out, you know, the stress would have gone to hand. There aren't enough saints in the Himalayas. There aren't enough saints in all the monasteries and Zen Buddhist saints and all the, you know, Orthodox saints and so on, and all the priests and all the holy men in the world. There weren't enough to counterbalance the horrible technology and avarice and greed and so many forms of ignorance. And we needed actually the householders to get involved. We needed people that lived and worked in the world to become saints. Contrary to common opinions, that there is that householders should be saints as well as, you know, someone asked Maharshi during my teacher training course, what is the ideal way to raise a child, you know? And Maharshi's answer was just so profound. He said, endless love. Just give full love. And then if they do something really, really bad, you just pull back 1% of that love and it'll get their full attention. But, you know, that was such an ideal and it was so true. We knew that people don't respond to the loss of love until they really, really have it the full. And then you don't have to take very much away, just the slightest, as we all learned from Maharshi when we worked with him and so on. His love was unbounded. But if his attention wasn't right quite on us, we would search our hearts to see how we could be better and so on like that. And everybody went through that unqualified love experience with Maharshi, and it was beautiful, those that served him. So there are paths, and there are different ways of life. Maharshi's way of life was recluse, but he wound up traveling around the world more than anybody that I've ever met. And my path was to be a student. But I had, in that student period, wonderful experiences with saints, and I aspired to be a saint. And in that sense, I think all of Maharshi's students have become saints. And if they find anything wrong with themselves, why, they have the path of pure bliss to correct them, you know. If somehow you pinch that bliss, which you experience in your meditation, by saying something bad about somebody or, you know, having some self-pity or something like that, and then you miss the bliss, just like a parent giving 100%. Bliss to the child. You miss the bliss, and then you do anything to get back into that correct action so that you can live your life in fulfillment.
Thank you so much. I think we'll end on that note of fulfillment. We'll continue on this level of bliss. So you've been listening to World Radio KHOE 90.5 FM. I'm Kathy Guarini. This is a chat with the Dean, and we've been listening to Peter Wallace, one of the earliest meditators, and we'll have many more such conversations.
Thank you, Catherine. It's a joy to be here with you and Stan. It's a lovely, lovely joy.
Sacred.
The all-time truth of life is the ever-evolving nature of life. We know the natural flow of our life is towards more and more, more happiness, more knowledge, and more intelligence. This natural tendency of the mind in the direction of the infinite is the basic motivating force which sustains this technique or process of the mind. Diving deep into the pool of being and bringing the value of the depth of being to the surface waves of living. And this is how the inner spiritual value of being is harmonized with the outer material values of action. It's a direct way for integration of life and integration of personality, and it's simple. And this is what I've been saying while I was singing. The inward march of the mind in meditation, and then its plunge into activity. Both are natural phenomena. As in the case of diving, we know we have only to learn how to take a correct angle and then let go. In the practice of transcendental meditation, we have only to learn how to start and then let go. And it's due to the simplicity, the universal nature of the technique, and the effectiveness of its results in day-to-day life, that transcendental meditation has gained a worldwide status. The wisdom is complete in both its theoretical and its practical value, and the technique for practice is based on the all-time truth of life. All gratitude to Maharishi and the holy tradition of the great masters of eternal wisdom of life.